giving him the rest. Too curious not to, Dan then began to load the footage from Trey's primary camera onto his computer while the others crowded around the news footage from California. More than anyone else, Tara in particular was entranced by what the anchors were already describing as the most spectacular incident of a spectacular week. When Dan glanced again at the TV while the huge video files copied to his hard drive, that one glance was enough to see why. C-minus 20. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. Chaos. There was, quite simply, no other word to describe the frenzied scenes inside the GSC's imposing headquarters as staff members of all levels of seniority reacted to Chairman Godfrey's demand for a tireless and immediate damage limitation campaign in the aftermath of yet another highly visible celestial event over the mainland United States. Only a few hours had passed since he sent President Slater the report she'd requested about the previous night's satellite incident over Montana, but the immense visibility of the even more recent incident in California meant that the GSC was under more scrutiny than ever before. Godfrey's meeting room was the only scene of relative order in the building, with a select handful of analysts and advisors gathered around his long table. More seats were empty than occupied following his ruthless post-leak purge of suspected moles and saboteurs, and the GSC chairman's rabid intensity made many of those present wish they hadn't survived it themselves. "Enough is enough," he said, slamming his fist on the table and rising to his feet. "First Kerguelen, then the junk satellite, and now this? Someone is trying to make us look weak. Someone is trying to make our people feel unsafe." "Sir," one brave young advisor chimed in, "what exactly are you suggesting? Covert military engagements? Psychological warfare? We could seed those ideas in the media, but where are you pointing the finger?"
"I didn't say anything about pointing fingers," Godfrey snapped in response. "And what I'm suggesting, which is a choice bloody word, I'll tell you that, is that you all start doing your damn jobs and find out what the hell is going on here. Why don't you start by looking for relationships between the locations and timings of these incidents?"
"What kind of relationships?" asked a more senior data analyst, taking over from the scolded and cowering young advisor.
"I'm not here to hold your hands," Godfrey moaned. "Use your imaginations, but for the record, in case your imaginations fail you, I'm starting to think that perhaps these messengers of ours are trying to tell us something. If they are, whatever the message is, we need to work it out before anyone else does."
No one chimed in this time.
"I also want a prompt strategic analysis of how this could fit into a pre-invasion distraction scenario. I don't care who does the report. It's on all of you to make sure that someone puts it in my hand within the next few hours."
"Invasion? An invasion by who?" the senior analyst asked, knowing full well that he was risking a firm rebuke.
"You don't really mean them?"
Godfrey's volume reached new heights.
"Who the hell else could I mean? This is the GSC, not a national government or military. How could any other force invade the planet, you idiot?"
Not only did no one else address Chairman Godfrey, now no one even risked making eye contact.
"Get to work!"
he yelled, dismissing them all at once. The stampede, as Godfrey's staff escaped as quickly as they could, wasn't quite on the level of school children running out of their classroom as the final bell of the school year signaled the beginning of summer, but it wasn't far off. On Monday, some of Godfrey's staff had heard him mention the possibility of imminent alien contact. None had taken it too seriously, but his repetition of the same idea, allied to the admittedly eyebrow-raising timing of recent events in Montana and California, caused many to realize that he was serious, and to wonder if he just might be right. With his lackeys dismissed, Godfrey wasted no time in turning back to the live American news reports, which had so far proven far more useful at keeping him in the loop than had his well-paid staff. One thing Godfrey had been told by his staff was that the California Fireball, as it had already been simply christened, was very likely an Earth-grazing asteroid. Nevertheless, the word bolide, a word which hardly anyone had been familiar with until a few days earlier, was being thrown around by the media despite being obviously incorrect. This fireball certainly didn't explode, and nor did it burn up on entry in the manner of a more typical meteor. Instead, it very clearly exited Earth's atmosphere around 2 minutes after entering. It came, and it went. The fireball was less brilliant, in the most literal sense of the word, than the Kerguelen bolide. This was easily understood. Early data suggested that the asteroid had passed spectacularly but relatively unscathed through Earth's atmosphere around 55 kilometers from the surface, whereas the Kerguelen bolide had exploded with tremendous force at an altitude of just 30 kilometers. In terms of societal impact, however, the Californian incident was on a different scale entirely. Unlike the Kerguelen bolide and Montana satellite, both of which had been observed directly by very few people, this fireball appeared to be an excellent contender for the titles of the most observed, most recorded, and most discussed of all unforeseen celestial events in human history, despite being far from the most extraordinary in strictly astronomical terms. Some 10 minutes after the event, news networks were already drawing comparisons to 1972's Great Daylight Fireball, which had also been referenced in media features in the aftermath of Kerguelen. But whereas that bygone event had been seen by thousands of eyewitnesses who took hundreds of photos, the immediate dissemination of breaking news, combined with the total market penetration of smartphones, ensured that the California fireball had been seen in the flesh by millions of snap-happy eyewitnesses taking tens of millions of photos, as well as ultra HD video footage from all conceivable ground-based locations. As was always the case, many eyewitnesses were already exaggerating aspects of their sightings. Some young observers would even later swear that the asteroid had been no higher than a helicopter. Such was its stunning nature and their level of awe. A map then appeared on Blitz News, with a rough rectangle indicating the extent of the area in which sightings had been made. It was a large area encompassing a huge population base, with the four corners taking in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Reno, and Las Vegas. A smaller red circle then appeared within the rectangle, north of Fresno and east of San Jose. The newsreader in the studio explained that the circle was an automatically generated heat spot. "Tonight, we're lucky enough to have unprecedentedly vast swaths of live social media data to pour through," she said, "and we're looking at a level of data which would have been unimaginable just a decade ago. I'm reliably told that photographs have been shared and messages which have been posted are all being fed, millions at a time, through systems which are far more complicated than anyone in this newsroom could ever hope to understand. I'm also told that this nice little heat spot corresponds to the area where unfiltered photographs show the fireball to be brighter than in photographs from elsewhere, and also where the language used in related posts is more excitable than in posts from elsewhere. Like I said, folks, it's more complicated than we can grasp, but the boffins are telling us that this circle will very probably turn out to include the precise spot where this fireball was at its closest point to our fragile planet's surface." Though it was a trivial annoyance in the grand scheme of things, the unnecessary tossing in of the word fragile irked Godfrey, who knew that people were going to be hysterical enough without nonsense like that making it worse. In any case, a sequence of photographs introduced as postcard-worthy snaps then appeared one by one on the right half of the screen, while the map remained on the left, with the exact size and position of the red heat spot changing in real time. Just like with that heat spot, Blitz News had to do no work of their own in collating this handful of viral images, all of which had already risen above the mediocre millions via the streamlined machinations of various social media platforms. There was an unmissable flippancy to the tone of the comments attached to most of the heavily shared photographs of the fireball, in contrast to the total fear felt by most of those who didn't encounter it firsthand. And while many on couches around the world watched on with concern, a huge number of in-person observers had snapped pictures of themselves smiling with the fireball in the background. Godfrey internally linked this phenomenon to a video he'd seen on the news just a few weeks earlier of two rhinos charging at a safari jeep. Scared or not, modern man's first instinct in any novel situation was evidently to reach for his phone and record whatever came next. All of the spectacular images appearing on TV came from within the rectangular zone, which had been identified minutes earlier, although the fact that many came from the extreme edges made Godfrey unhappily think that the rectangle should probably have been larger than it was. The very first of the images was beautiful in its simplicity, with a fireball streaking across the otherwise crystal-clear night sky above the Sierra Nevada. The second featured the fireball framing the Golden Gate Bridge, while in the third it cut an equally photogenic shooting star pose above the Hollywood sign. The fourth and final image in this short sequence saw the fireball outshining the Vegas Strip, as the Blitz News anchor put it. It was easy for Godfrey to see why these particular images had proven so popular. They were skillfully composed and made clever use of angles to show the fireball positioned in relation to certain landmarks in ways that weren't entirely representative of what people on the ground really saw. But he knew that the sheer scale of the number of sightings was what could well ensure that this incident might prove to be a watershed moment of the worst kind for his already precarious GSC leadership. "I'm sure you'll agree that each of those images was more impressive than the last," the anchor beamed, striking Godfrey as inappropriately flippant. "And who's to say that some even better ones won't be with us in the next few moments?" For William Godfrey, on the other hand, it seemed that every day lately had been worse than the last. He would have loved to think that this was as bad as it could get, but he had been in politics long enough to know better than that. Little did Godfrey know that in a small farm cottage some 6,000 miles north of his Buenos Aires home, a defiant old foe was conspiring to make this wretched night a whole lot worse than he could ever imagine. C-19. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado.
"Joe, it's me," Richard Walker calmly said, speaking into the relatively new phone which Joe Crabb himself had delivered along with a new computer after Emma Ford and the McCarthy brothers wisely took everything on the night of the DS-1 launch disaster and Walker's simultaneous disappearance. Joe and the rest of the world knew nothing about that episode, of course, but the California fireball had now convinced Walker once and for all that it was time for that to change. "I want to do a live video interview," Walker continued. "There's something I need to tell the world, something I've wanted to get off my chest for a long time. It shouldn't take much more than 20 minutes.
"Of course," Joe enthusiastically replied, fondly remembering the exponential spike in viewing and listening figures he had enjoyed after Walker appeared on Crabshoot Radio around a year earlier to defend his decision to cover up all proof of the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. Naturally, Joe had no idea of the palpable irony of the topic Walker intended to broach on this occasion.
"Can I have 20 minutes to get everything ready?"
"Certainly, but Joe, I need you to make me a promise. I need you to promise, that you won't cut this interview off."
"Why would I do something like that?" Joe asked.
Walker hesitated, choosing his words carefully.
"Because you're not going to like what I have to say," he eventually said. "No one is going to like what I have to say."
"Well, I absolutely promise that I'll let you say it, every single word." Walker hung up without saying goodbye. He then poured himself 2 glasses of whiskey, as was his way. Some visitors over the years had no doubt thought he did this for show, to make people talk, as he often liked to do, but they didn't know the truth. It was more of a family custom than a habit, one Walker had picked up from his own father, a stoic man who died too young. Franklin Walker had always poured himself 2 glasses, and he explained to the inquisitive young Richard that he did so in tribute to his own late father, with whom he had shared many a glass.
"One day that second glass will be yours," Franklin had told his son, and on the boy's 14th birthday he proved true to his word. From that day onwards the 2 glasses were shared between them. Franklin unwaveringly poured and drank an extra glass every night during the harrowing spell when Richard was held captive in Vietnam, and Richard had maintained the custom every time he'd sat down for a drink since the night of Franklin's untimely passing. Richard hadn't expected to reflect on this after calling Joe, but the thoughts were there, and they quickly turned to regrets,
that he had never had a son of his own to slide that second glass to like his father had slid it to him. This particular regret didn't last long when Richard reflected on the state of the world and the sickening weakness of its leaders. He wouldn't wish 80 years in a world of Valerie Slaters and William Godfrey's on his worst enemy, much less a child of his own.
"Here, boy," Walker called, beckoning his loyal dog, Rooster. "If they do something to stop me, Joe will be here soon. Joe, remember Joe? Joe will come to get you. But if they come back, you can go outside. Outside, okay?"
Rooster looked up at him like any dog would, wondering what the hell his owner was saying and how the hell he expected him to understand it. Walker stood up and placed a large bag of dog food in the hallway, open at the top and tipped on its side. He then filled 3 water bowls and opened the external doors at both ends of the house. This had the dual effect of creating a wind tunnel and confusing Rooster even further.
"Stay," Walker said, "unless they come back."
"Stay" was one word the dog did understand, of course, but the rest meant nothing. He sat obediently on the kitchen floor.
"Good dog," Walker said.
He walked towards his bedroom, computer in hand, then stopped at the door and looked back.
"You always were a good dog," he added, quickly going inside and closing the door behind him before he got emotional.
He firmly trusted that Rooster wouldn't leave unless something spooked him, in which case Walker would hate for him to be trapped, so the possibility of him making a thoughtless exit in pursuit of a passing bird or whatever else might appear outside was a risk that had to be taken. Inside his bedroom, Walker set the computer down on his bedside table and opened the chat window where Joe Crabb would appear as soon as he was ready. Richard Walker didn't fear many things, but his heart was beating fast. C-18. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Within around 20 seconds, Dan realized that his computer's estimate of how long it was going to take Trey's primary Ultra HD video footage to be copied from the memory card wasn't incorrect and wasn't going to change. It really was going to take the better part of an hour.
"Time is against us," he said, walking away from the computer and joining the others in gazing at his giant TV. "Trey's footage isn't going anywhere, and we need to nail down a specific location for this fireball as quickly as we can."
"Look at that rectangle where people have seen it, and look at that heat spot,"
Tara said, still the most excited member of the group in the wake of Dan's prediction that something was going to happen in either California or North Dakota, having come true in such spectacular fashion.
"The heat spot couldn't be any more central within your corridor of expectation."
Dan then glanced between the TV and his wall. Tara was correct, but what bothered him was that none of his illustrative triangles had a point inside the exact area of that heat spot. Those speculative triangles had their third points, the potential location of the plaque, falling on places like Denver, Colorado Springs, and Pikes Peak. At a very rough estimate, it looked to Dan that if the second point was indeed within the heat spot shown on the news, the plaque might be somewhere to the northwest of Birchwood, around halfway to Aspen. Mount Elbert, which many saw as the likely identity of the rockiest peak mentioned in Humphrey Finch's infamous prophecy, was the closest location to that point which Dan had considered, but even it wasn't perfectly aligned.
"I need something more precise than this heat spot," Dan said. "Timo, will there be anyone in the observatory at this time of night? I know it's not exactly business hours in Italy right now."
"Someone is always there," Timo replied. "It may be too early for anyone to have extracted information from any old friends of the GSC, but we can always try. And that information is certainly coming because Godfrey is a lame duck. From what I have heard, the discontent at some facilities has already been shifting towards insubordination, and after this it's bound to start tipping over the edge towards full-blown mutiny."
As Emma authorized Timo to dial the observatory's number from Dan's wired phone, Dan heard the words, "Earth-grazing asteroid," spoken on TV for the first time since he'd been paying full attention.
"That makes 3 completely different kinds of widely observed lights in the sky," he said. "Kerguelen was a super bolide, Montana was a dying satellite, and this is an earth grazer.
I don't know what the difference between the nature of the events means, but it has to mean something. Obviously, the messengers are leading us to the plaque, but they're also putting on a show for everyone else, and none of the details are random. Terra, previously entranced by the incoming photographs of the California Fireball alongside all manner of famous landmarks, joined the conversation at this point.
What if this is like that whole boiling a frog thing you guys have talked about before? You know, the thing when someone reduces the impact of something big by slowly turning up the heat with smaller things along the way? Maybe the aliens are going to show up, and before then, they want to do some stuff to make everyone pay attention to different kinds of things arriving from above, so that their final arrival isn't such a massive shock when it comes?
Clark said, turning away from the TV as Terra said this. That sounds like something that could actually be true.
Maybe I'm smarter than I look,
Terra said with a wink. Just as well, Clark quipped, immediately earning himself a punch in the arm. I think that sounds as plausible as anything else, Dan said, because if they do ever decide to openly show up, I can't imagine it would be sudden or unannounced. They would maybe send an unmanned craft, which could be discovered and studied, and even that would be after they'd started slowly boiling the frog with uncloaked flights over populated areas and stuff like that. Alessandro, Timo boomed, delighted by the identity of the astronomer who answered his call after so many rings that he'd begun to think no one was there after all. I am so glad it's you. I'm with Dan, and he has some questions. Dan hurried to the phone. Is this confirmed as an Earth-grazing asteroid? He asked, wasting no time or words. That much is clear, Alessandro Bonucci said, happy to be speaking to his old friend for the first time in too long, but immediately understanding that brevity was the order of the moment. I need precise coordinates of its perigee, Dan said. Its point of closest approach. I need to know exactly where it was passing over when it was closest to the ground. Understandably, this caught Alessandro off guard.
Why?
Because I do. Do you have that information?
Dan, of course I don't. The GSC won't even have solid data on that yet. They'll have data, but they won't be confident in it. Remember Chelyabinsk? It took NASA weeks to publish the authoritative report that included their confident assessment of the location of its peak brightness. And it's been, what, 15 minutes since this asteroid passed through?
Weeks, Dan echoed incredulously.
I should have a fairly precise perigee in less than a day, Alessandro said. I was just trying to make the point that official things don't happen quickly. I'll have the info for you as soon as I can get it. So far, my own tracking of the most detailed eyewitness reports regarding the points of atmospheric entry and exit, which can typically be determined more quickly than the point of closest approach. Well, that tracking so far leads me to think that the perigee was very likely at a point that's fairly consistent with this so-called heat spot that's been all over every news station. Have you seen that? It's maybe also worth mentioning that we had solid information about the size and equivalent yield of the 2012 Sutter's Mill meteorite, which was also fairly close to the locations we're looking at tonight, within no more than a day or two. So, like I said, the kind of precise data you need will be here soon. But again, I have to ask, why do you need it?
What's the thing about Sutter's Mill? Dan asked, focusing squarely on that tangent. Is that the same Sutter's Mill where the California Gold Rush started?
Yes, that's where the meteorite's name came from. It was a daytime bolide which occurred in April 2012, and it was relatively well observed for that kind of incident. No fragments any larger than 200 grams were found, but those who saw the meteor spoke of a long, bright trail. Let me just check. Yes, it possessed between 3 and 4 kilotons of energy before it broke apart around 50 kilometers from the surface.
A pebble compared to what we saw at Kerguelen for sure, and it was certainly much less exciting and lower profile than what we've seen tonight. With the unprecedented level of observation and public interest, we'll know everything about this latest fireball extremely soon. So, Dan, I may as well try one more time. Why is this so important?
Timo, listening in, took the phone from Dan after silently asking for permission.
Alessandro, the situation is complicated, he said. What I ask is that you provide me with regular updates of your most precise estimate of the perigee. Let's say you have a circle. As you receive and analyze more data, it should get smaller. Shouldn't it? Please let me know every time it does.
Will do,
Alessandro said, apparently having given up on seeking any answers of his own.
out of interest, would precise location data on the junk satellite which fell over Montana be of any use to you? Something tells me that this fireball's location isn't important all on its own.
Dan, hearing these words, spoke into the phone while Timo held it.
We already have what we need on that front, he said,
tacitly confirming Alessandro's suspicion.
Okay, the astronomer said. My estimate is that I'll have something useful in a few hours and something definite by the time you both wake up. Is there any estimate on when you can tell me what this is all about? He added, laughing slightly.
Just as soon as we have a definitive answer, Alessandro, Timo replied with a chuckle of his own.
As soon as we have the answer.
Moments after the call ended, a loud and sudden chime startled everyone. It sounded like it came from the basement's ceiling, and only Dan knew what it meant.
Ticker, he said, pointing to the Wall Street-style trend ticker, which, rather than stock prices, scrolled an endless loop of exceptionally viral posts related to accounts and keywords Dan followed. When a post achieved truly extraordinary levels of sudden viral penetration, which happened perhaps once a month and usually only when someone died, the ticker emitted a loud chime. The threshold for this chime was user-customizable, and Dan had set it to only kick in at the most important moments of all. Events like the Kerguelen Boli didn't register because news of them was never spread by a single post, like the breaking news of a death more typically was, which was why none of the recent celestial events had led to this kind of chime. Dan knew that whatever it was all about had to be seriously big, and his best guess was some kind of official and strongly worded post from President Slater, who had so far kept almost suspiciously quiet over recent events.
Oh, fuck, Clark said, immediately jumping to his feet. Dan hadn't caught the start of the post on its first loop, only seeing, "It's going to be big, hashtag unmissable." As the message looped again and Dan saw the first part, he fully understood Clark's response. Post by Joe_Crab_USA. Huge news coming straight from the horse's mouth. Tune in for a live and exclusive interview with Richard Walker in 20 minutes. There's something he has to get off his chest, and he promised me it's going to be big. Hashtag unmissable.
Go, Emma said, responding to Clark's approval-seeking expression.
Go where? Timo asked.
Walker is only 3 miles away, Dan answered.
Clark, I'll come with you.
No, you won't, Emma and Clark both replied, shooting this particular idea down in perfect unison.
Everyone just wait a second,
Tara said, not quite yelling but speaking just about as loudly as she could.
Just 1 second, okay? I'm guessing the three of you are worried that Walker is going to confess about the hoax, yeah? But why not just let him do it? He's not going to cloud things by mentioning anything about you. If he's doing this, he's doing that emergency stop thing. Dan, remember all the stuff you told me that he told you a few nights ago? And you said he was pretty nice to you that night. Why would he bring you guys into this? He'll just say that he tricked everyone because he felt like he had to, and now he feels like he has to come clean because, you know, all that American sovereignty stuff and all his fears about the GSC?
No one said anything for several seconds. In the last 5 minutes, Dan and Clark had both come to realize that in terms of deep thinking and astute observations, Tara had a lot more in common with Emma than they'd previously thought.
This could be your way out of all the stress of the secret, Tara continued. Maybe this is all part of what's meant to happen.
Emma turned to look at Dan, successfully catching his eye. She hadn't said anything yet, but he could tell that she was about to do so if he didn't.
No, he said. It's a good idea, but this isn't just about us. If it was, Walker confessing like this would be perfect, because I really don't think he would mention us either.
It's about stability, Emma added. Tara, I can't remember if you were there when I said this, but belief in the content of the IDA leak is a core part of reality as experienced by everyone on this planet, except for Richard Walker and the 5 people in this basement. If that rug of reality was pulled from under everyone's feet at once, that would be a very dangerous thing. But for that to happen at a time when people are already so angry at their leaders and so frightened by this surge in talk about bolides and fireballs and satellites and, yeah, even aliens, that would be deadly. There would be riots everywhere. People would die. Tonight. And it would be our fault for letting Walker talk.
Tara nodded.
Okay, I was just...
You don't have to explain, Clark said, standing at the bottom of the stairs and getting ready to run. Seriously, it was a smart idea. But they're right. This is so much bigger than us. Even if it was absolutely guaranteed that Walker wouldn't mention us, I would never forgive myself if I let him do this. I don't think the messengers would actually let him say it anyway. But just in case they're not still keeping an eye on him after all this time, I have to stop him.
Go, Emma said.
Clark, I have to say, Timo began. I am a human being, so I had my doubts, but this puts to bed the idea that your collective silence over the course of the last year has been anything other than a selfless struggle. He turned to Dan. It's one thing to say that you are bearing a difficult load for selfless reasons, but it's another thing altogether to maintain that load when circumstances present an easy way out of your difficulties.
Thanks, man, Clark said, but we should probably save the reflections for later.
Emma, equally as focused as Clark, implored one final precaution. Whatever happens, make sure you take all of Walker's security camera footage. All of it.
Good thinking, he replied. Anything else?
Just be safe,
Tara chimed in. Emma shook her head.
Nothing else. Good luck.
Clark, itching to run, looked at his silent and pensive younger brother.
Dan?
Eventually, Dan spoke.
Whatever it takes, you have to stop him.
Clark nodded before hurrying up the stairs.
Whatever it takes, Dan called after him. No half measures.
C-17. Torship, Southern Ocean. Despite a growing tiredness that was beginning to approach exhaustion, Billy Kendrick sat in a quiet cabin looking into his computer's webcam and tried to appear energetic as he conducted his 9th live interview of the day. Of all the important players in the complicated history of the IDA leak that many observers believed was somehow related to recent events, Billy alone had been physically present to see the Kerguelen bolide. As such, his views on the California fireball were at the top of the wanted list for countless news stations around the world.
I don't know where Montana fits in, Billy admitted for the 4th time in an hour. Maybe it doesn't, since that was a man-made satellite in a decaying orbit rather than a space-borne wanderer. And you can call me crazy for saying this, but the timing of this satellite thing doesn't feel like an accident.
So what does it feel like? The interviewer asked, persisting with the tactic of staying out of the way as much as possible and prodding Billy with open questions only when necessary.
Like something big is going on, he replied. I think it's high time for President Slater and other conscientious national leaders to press for a full audit of the GSC. What exactly are we paying for here? What exactly is really going on in Buenos Aires? Because whether this is some sleight of hand by Godfrey to push for more power, or whether it actually is second contact in the form of a coded message, or maybe even as a precursor to direct contact, the only thing we can count on is that Godfrey knows more than we do. I'm not here to call for further protests, but the question I'd ask is a simple one. Are we okay with this? Are we really okay with a career politician running a global space agency that's funded by national governments, or, to be more accurate, one that's funded almost entirely by American and Western European taxpayers, yet answers to no one? If nothing of note was going on in the sky, this would still be an important question. But with everything that is going on, this could literally be life or death.
Well, Mr. Kendrick, we certainly don't want to strike a tone of alarmism or...
Listen to me, Billy interrupted. If you can sit there with a straight face and convince me that we have any reason to believe that the GSC is doing everything possible to make sure we're safe, well, then and only then will I let you throw around words like alarmism. But how about realism? How about we start throwing that word around?
The interviewer fumbled over a few words while receiving instructions in her earpiece.
Live? Now? Yes, okay. Mr. Kendrick, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for now, but...
Of course you are, Billy sighed, only too accustomed to this kind of thing happening whenever he moved towards topics which the news networks would rather avoid.
Really, Billy? The interviewer replied in a more urgent and focused tone. Richard Walker is about to begin a live video interview with Joe Crabb.
Billy's eyes widened. He hadn't seen any headlines for several hours, so had no idea this was coming,
and it was just about the last thing he'd expected to hear. He chuckled slightly through a half-smile.
Just very quickly, I want to let it be known that I support the growing calls for the U.S. to withdraw from the GSC with immediate effect, he said. Something tells me that Walker might be about to say something similar, so I just want to get that in first. But yeah, thanks for having me on tonight, and let's hear what the old bastard has to say.
C-16. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado. With his visual attention shared between the road, the time, and the speedometer, Clark made the short drive to Richard Walker's cottage with only one thought in his mind. No half measures. Those had been Dan's final words before Clark left the basement, and they rang true. By any means necessary, he quite simply had to prevent Walker's live interview with the odious Joe Crabb. Taking the semi-concealed turn onto the narrow road to Stevenson Farm didn't feel as odd as it would have if Clark hadn't been there with Dan so recently, but it still brought back some uneasy memories of the night when they found Walker's bed empty while his dog went crazy in the hallway. As he approached the cottage, going right to the doorstep instead of parking further away to avoid wasting too much time on foot, Clark noticed that the front door was wide open. This didn't exactly ease his mind, but there was no backing down. Rooster came dashing out of the house as Clark made the few steps from his car. Fortunately, the dog was excited to see him rather than spooked by anything otherworldly, as had been the case a year earlier, and Clark led him back inside before closing the front door. "Walker," he called, with no way of knowing that the old man already had his noise-canceling headphones on. Clark then saw that the back door was open too, and he hurried to close it before Rooster could run out that way. As he did this, the thought hit him that Walker would also be considering that the messengers might intervene. Almost certainly, the doors were open precisely so that Rooster would indeed have a way out. "Don't worry," he said to the oblivious dog. "I'm here." Clark then looked at Walker's bedroom door and put his hand on the knob. "Ah, Joe," Walker boomed. "At last." Clark heard this through the door. He immediately opened it while crouching down. Being seen on camera would be a disaster that even Emma would struggle to clean up. Then, desperately looked around the room for something to throw at Walker to capture his attention. While untying his own shoe in the absence of any better options, Clark felt a sudden and unbelievably powerful force as a bright flash filled the bedroom, and something threw him backwards against the wall on the other side of the narrow hallway. He could immediately feel a pounding in his head, and for several panicked seconds, he struggled to inhale any air as pains shot up and down the side of his body. Rooster, for his part, sprinted into the kitchen and began knocking things down all over the place as he desperately searched for a way out. Clark caught his breath at last and pushed himself to his hands and knees. A faint humming noise filled the air, but Clark couldn't be sure whether or not it was all in his head following a serious full-body impact with the wall. The threshold between Walker's bedroom and the hallway was consumed by a total light that defied all logic. It didn't spill into the hallway, but it utterly concealed the bedroom despite the door being wide open. "Do it," Walker said as clear as day over the faint hum. "And at least finish the job this time, you bug-eyed sons of bitches." "Walker!" Clark roared. Through severe aches and pains, now most pronounced in his ribs and neck, he forced himself to his feet. Whether or not Walker heard his words, no reply came. The humming, previously so obvious, ceased as quickly as it had begun. Faded wasn't the right word for this kind of instant change, and Clark took a long, deep breath as he gazed at the light in the doorway. Following the disorienting events of the last 20 seconds, Clark gave no further thought to the webcam inside Walker's bedroom. Fortunately for him, the computer was no longer functioning. As the same kind of animalistic survival instincts that were still driving Rooster crazy encouraged Clark to turn and run away, his mind turned to Dan and Emma, to how they had unquestioningly trusted him with this task, and to how they were so fully counting on him to be thorough. Clark McCarthy didn't know what was on the other side of the threshold, and was anything but sure that he wanted to find out. But there was no one else to do the job. He held his breath and charged at Richard Walker's bedroom, towards the door, and into the light. C-minus 15. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan pushed himself to his feet, reeling from the most intense neck pain yet. There were tears in his eyes, and there were tears in Emma's. Both had endured an almost unimaginably intense sensation, like a spike being driven deep into their skin. At the precise moment when the feed from Richard Walker's live interview had been consumed by a total white flash before cutting out completely just milliseconds later, Tara, seeing them deal with this kind of pain for the first time, was almost hysterical in her concern. Timo didn't feel much more comfortable, but in an odd way, the extent and intensity of Tara's panic had forced him to be calm. He held her back while Emma convulsed, a mercifully brief part of the incident. But if Dan and Emma had remained in their helpless and frightening state for much longer, he had no idea what he would have done. Fortunately, they hadn't, and Dan helped Emma to her feet just after rising himself. As seemed to be typical, he didn't suffer quite so badly as she did. He didn't know why, and there wasn't much in it, but it was something they had both noticed. Tara wrapped her arms around Emma as soon as she was lucid, but Emma pushed her away after barely a second. "You two go next door," she told Tara and Timo. "We have to go and see what happened." "Who else knows where Walker lives?" Timo asked. "No one," Dan said. "But who cares? Clark could be in trouble." "If anyone else knows where he lives, they're going to be on the way there right now," Timo said. "Are you sure that—" "Joe Crabb and no one else," Emma said. "And he's hundreds of miles away. There's a small chance he might call the emergency services if he tries to call Walker and can't get hold of him. But why would he? If you don't know what we know, that would have looked like a computer failure or a power cut." Dan ran up the stairs. "Dan, act cool," Emma called. "Your dad—" Dan tried to compose himself as he walked through the house towards the front door.
"Are you watching this shit?"
Henry asked from his usual spot by the couch.
"Crabb was supposed to be interviewing Walker, but the feed cut out. Total bullshit if you ask me. Typical Crabb to promise something and not deliver."
"Yup, typical Crabb," Emma said. "Anyway, we're just going next door to check something on my computer."
Henry raised a hand of acknowledgement without turning away from the TV. Without telling anyone else, much less asking if he could, Timo broke the script and walked over to Henry. "Mr. McCarthy, before I go, I just want to congratulate you for raising two good men of such moral standing." Henry nodded, quietly grateful for the comment, then grinned.
"Have you definitely met Clark?" he asked.
Timo patted him on the shoulder before joining the others at the door where Dan was putting on his shoes. Emma, unimpressed, pointed towards her house and ushered Timo outside.
"Be really, really careful,"
Tara pleaded as Emma and Dan walked to the car.
"We can't just leave him," Emma said. "We don't know what happened."
Tara nodded weakly. "But if there are any risks, I'll take them," Dan said. He meant it. He would insist on being the one to take whatever risks were required. But he said it out loud mainly in an effort to ease Tara's concerns over Emma's safety.
"I was telling both of you to be careful," Tara replied,
an attempt at a smile crossed her lips.
"But thanks for trying."
Dan got in the passenger seat of Emma's car and fumbled to buckle his seatbelt. Emma tore out of the driveway and drove like they were being chased by lava. This fast was perhaps too fast in the eyes of the law, but it was nowhere near fast enough as far as Dan was concerned. Throughout the short journey, Dan tried calling Clark over and over again. Every time it went straight to voicemail. Disconcertingly, this suggested that Clark's phone may have fallen victim to the same forces as Walker's computer. Dan thought back to their fateful night in Lolo National Forest, when Clark's phone had exploded in his pocket and badly burned his thigh. He also recalled Clark's persistent inability to pass through invisible thresholds, which Emma and Dan could pass through unfazed. For whatever reason, the messengers had never afforded Clark the same status. Dan didn't know quite what this different status entailed, but the word protection was bouncing around his mind.
"Dan, what are we going to find when we get there?"
Emma asked, speaking for the first time during the drive and speaking in a genuinely helpless tone for the first time Dan could ever remember. "They wouldn't hurt him on purpose," Dan said, convinced by this at least. "And I really don't think they would take him." Before long, Emma made the turn onto the narrow road which led to the all-too-familiar cottage. When this is over, I don't want to waste any more time, she said. Dan turned sideways to look at her for a clue as to what she meant, but just as he did so, a bright light entered the car from up ahead. It was a beam, rather than a flash, and it was getting brighter. His car? Emma yelled excitedly. She flashed her own headlights several times, then pulled up at the side of the narrow road. The rapidly approaching car skidded to a reckless halt, and Dan quickly saw that the plate was indeed Clark's. It's definitely him, he said. Obviously, Emma said with a relieved chuckle. They ran outside and straight towards Clark's door. In too much pain to step out unnecessarily, Clark rolled down his window as they approached. Dan arrived first. What happened? He called as soon as he saw that the window was open. Clark reached up towards the light switch next to his rearview mirror. Even this small action sent an ache running through his shoulder, and speaking hurt like hell. They got to him before I did, he said, flicking the switch to illuminate the car's interior. Dan's mouth fell open just as Emma arrived beside him, not because of what he heard, but because of what he saw. Wearing a blunt look of exhaustion mixed with uncharacteristic distress, Clark McCarthy's face was absolutely covered in blood. C-14. 10 Downing Street, London, England. As John Cole caught a few hours of sleep, Jack Neal sat wide awake in the middle of the British night. Jack had spent the last hour following up on a lead which he hoped would be the one to get Cole off his case. He'd been handed a sizable slice of luck, and had known straight away who to contact to make the most of it. Now, at last, the off-the-books intelligence specialist had called him back. Jack held his phone in his hand, imploring it to give him some good news. Well, he asked, answering the call.
Good news, Mr. Neal,
a digitally disguised voice replied.
We have a decisive match, and it's going to interest you greatly.
Jack closed his eyes and breathed a sigh of blissful relief. After a few seconds spent basking in the warm glow of this fortuitous breakthrough, he snapped back to life and sat bolt upright. Send me what you have, he ordered. And pronto. I need to get started on the real work. C-13. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado.
Oh my God,
Emma yelled when she caught sight of Clark. His nose was badly bent out of shape, and almost his entire face was enveloped in a bloody crimson mask. The short story is that I ran face first into an invisible wall, Clark said, preempting the inevitable questions. A force field.
Are you okay? Emma asked.
Clark nodded slightly, moving his neck muscles no more than he had to. He then cracked his lower jaw back into place with his hands. This hurt for a second, but it made speaking far less painful. And don't worry, there was no blood on the floor or walls or anything else when I left. After inspecting Clark's facial injuries, Emma glanced into the back seat and saw Rooster.
So Walker is gone?
She asked, deducing as much, but keen to be sure.
He was taken?
Yeah, I heard him talking to Crab. I opened his bedroom door, but then there was a flash and a massive force threw me back against the wall on the other side of the hallway. The dog was going apeshit, and this weird humming or buzzing sound started. The door stayed open, but there was a white light. Then I heard Walker again, talking to them. And then everything was quiet. No humming, no buzzing, nothing. I ran towards the light in the doorway, and that was it. Bang. Face first. Walker's computer was dead, but I don't know exactly when it died. How much did you see on Crab's interview feed?
Nothing, Dan said. Walker was there for a few seconds, but there was no flash or anything. It just cut out. One second he was there on the right side of the screen with Crab on the left, and the next second it was Crab on one side and an empty black square on the other. That's what Tara and Timo said, anyway. Me and Emma felt it in our necks again, the worst yet, so we didn't see anything. The last thing I remember was Walker saying, Joe, at last. And then it hit me like a brick had fallen onto my neck from the top of a tower.
Clark thought for a few seconds.
So no one has any reason to suspect that something happened to Walker? That means we found something out. The messengers are keeping a close eye on everything. But that no one else learned anything. I'm pretty sure my nose is broken in at least two places, and it sounds like you guys had a rough time too. But this could have ended a lot worse.
And you definitely positively got all of the security camera footage? Emma asked. The part when they came will just be a flash, but obviously the part when you arrive will be there.
100%, Clark confirmed. I've got all the memory cards in my pocket, I've got the dog, and I'm still alive. Now we need to hurry up and get the hell out of here.
Emma hurried to the car and returned quickly with a small first aid kit.
You can't go home looking like that, she said, handing him the box.
Clark opened a pack of antiseptic wipes without looking at the label and wiped the blood from his face. He groaned and grimaced more than a little at an extreme stinging sensation he hadn't expected, having not realized that they weren't regular baby wipes. With the blood gone, the extent of the injury to Clark's nose became even clearer. Dan didn't say anything about it. There would have been no point. But he did offer to drive Clark home.
Thanks, man, but I'm good, Clark said. It's a lot less painful for me to drive than it would be for me to get out of this car and get back in on the other side. My back, my shoulder, and especially my ribs took a serious hit when the initial force threw me against the wall. Those fuckers don't take any prisoners when they're putting up their force fields, I could tell you that.
Clark rolled up his window in a clear sign that it was time to go. He let Emma turn her car around to lead the way home. Despite the craziness of the last half hour, Dan's mind turned towards California as Emma drove towards Birchwood. Clark tailed them until an unfortunately timed traffic light change created a break between their cars, which was filled by a few other vehicles, but they knew he wasn't far behind. Emma didn't say anything at all until they reached her driveway, which Dan would have registered as more than a little unusual had his mind not been fully occupied with so many other things.
I'm going to get Rooster out of the car and take him into my house as soon as Clark gets back, she said, getting out of the car to wait for their arrival.
Dan walked around to her side of the car and leaned back against its door.
Are you okay? He asked. This is a lot to deal with, she said, also leaning back and gazing up at the stars.
Yeah, I guess I've had a few quieter Wednesday nights, Dan quipped.
Emma smiled without laughing and turned to face him. The smile then faded as she shifted her feet, gazed into his eyes, put her hands on his cheeks, and softly kissed his lips. Softly. Unexpectedly. Perfectly. The revving of Clark's approaching car broke the serenity of this moment too soon, leaving Dan staring dumbly at Emma and wondering if this crazy Wednesday night could even be real as she turned towards the increasing noise and accompanying headlight beam. She then squeezed Dan's hand and looked at him again.
I'm scared, she said, uttering those words for what he thought must have been the first time in all the time he'd known her. And when I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, I don't want to keep wasting today's.
As Dan McCarthy looked into Emma Ford's eyes, he was feeling a lot of things. Scared wasn't one of them. Clark's car pulled into the McCarthy's driveway, at which point Emma made an immediate move to get Rooster from the back seat. Standing alone, Dan then turned towards the sudden sound of a fist knocking quickly and repeatedly on glass. He saw Tara standing at Emma's window, grinning like an idiot, and pointing two fingers at her own eyes before gesturing them towards Dan. I saw that. He didn't reply, instead turning to help Clark out of the car. Rooster was understandably quieter and less energetic than normal as Emma led him inside, but he looked calm enough, certainly compared to the manic state they'd found him in after the messenger's first intervention at Walker's cottage a year earlier. Your nose is really messed up, Dan said, no longer able to keep this thought to himself, as Clark slowly stepped out of the car.
It was like a fucking wall, Clark lamented. Just absolutely solid, and I ran right into it face first because I didn't even know it was there.
Are your teeth okay?
Clark opened his mouth and felt around to check, which obviously meant that they were.
Seems like it. My forehead took a bit of a hit, but my nose definitely bore the brunt of it, because I was lurching forward into the room. Seriously, man, if this was you, you'd still be squealing like a pig.
Dan shrugged. So what did you hear Walker saying the second time anyway, when you said he was talking to them?
You know when you hear stories of what one guy says when another guy is holding a gun to his head right before he's executed?
Clark said.
And you know how you can never be sure if it actually happened like that? Well, this did happen, because I heard it. He said, do it, and at least finish the job this time, you bug-eyed sons of bitches. That was the last thing he said. Those things were right there in his room, man, and he was talking to them like he was in charge. I'd like to think I would be so strong in that situation, but who knows? Richard Walker is a different breed. Well, he was.
There was no denying that, and Dan replied with a distant nod as he saw Timo and Tara coming over.
Emma said she'll come next door in a few minutes once Rooster is settled.
Tara explained right away. She turned to Dan.
So, anything exciting happened with you guys since you left?
Clark's hurt pretty badly, Dan replied, knowing full well what Tara was getting at.
It's not that bad, Clark said.
But Tara's playful smirk faded in an instant, and her eyes widened like dinner plates when she belatedly looked at Clark and saw his misshapen nose.
What the hell happened to you?
She shrieked.
I lost a fight with a force field,
Clark replied, trying to downplay it with a hint of humor and pointing towards his house to encourage Tara to start walking.
But listen, be cool and don't say anything until we're in the basement, okay? I don't want my dad to see me like this tonight. Or at least until I can think of something to say when he asks why I look like I've just gone 12 rounds with a pissed-off silverback.
Very subtly, Timo pulled Dan back as Tara and Clark approached the front door. He kept walking at Dan's side but slowed the pace to ensure they stayed out of the other's earshot. He then leaned towards Dan and spoke quietly.
Alessandro called when you were gone. He has a confident estimate of the perigree, which is far more precise than what he had when you left.
Really? Dan said, barely able to control his volume in the excitement of this revelation. How sure is he of his analysis?
Alessandro is very sure, but this isn't just his analysis, Timo replied. This has come from a very reliable friend inside the GSC's Argentine complex.
Perfect, Dan said. Timo's expression and tone, however, were far more measured.
But that's not all that our contact told Alessandro, he said. Apparently, Chairman Godfrey has ordered his top minds to assess the relationships between recent high-profile incidents, both in terms of the phenomena themselves and also their precise locations and timings.
He's specifically looking for relationships between the locations? Dan asked, suddenly far from happy. Why? Timo answered very bluntly, just as he and Dan stepped through the front door.
Well, Dan, it seems to me that he knows the aliens are sending us a message. Our saving grace for now is that he doesn't know anything about Lolo, but we really need to get our hands on this plaque as quickly as we can.
This perigree completes the map, Dan replied with a slow nod, wearing an expression of total focus. Now it's time to find our treasure.
Part 5. Treasure. There comes a time in every rightly constructed boy's life when he has a raging desire to go somewhere and dig for hidden treasure. Mark Twain. C-minus 12. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan had long feared that it was only a matter of time before others, powerful others, began searching for relationships between recent events which could no longer be dismissed as ordinary. But even though his group alone had the advantage of knowing that a certain spot in Lolo National Forest was a crucial piece of the puzzle, this made it no more palatable for Dan to learn that GSC Chairman William Godfrey was now asking questions about extraterrestrial involvement and looking for answers in the right kinds of places.
Alessandro has informed us that GSC staff are working on the basis of the Peregrine Point being near the northern shore of Huntington Lake, Timo announced as soon as he and Dan entered the basement.
He didn't mention the part about Godfrey's recent alien-related inquiries, leaving it for Dan to decide whether this was something that Tara and Clark would benefit from knowing right now. Emma buzzed the basement's exterior intercom just moments later, returning far sooner than expected and reporting that Rooster had settled in her house immediately. "He obviously remembers the place from his visit last year," she said.